Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. It's great to have you here this afternoon. Well, are you one of those people who takes those quizzes on social media? You know, those will come up and ask what kind of color you are or what kind of Disney princess you are. Ted, do you ever take those?
Not that one. I haven't answered that one. But yes, I have taken those. Sometimes you just go like, oh, I'm kind of curious and see.
Sure.
And then half an hour later, you go, oh, I'm late for an appointment.
Right. I like the ones that are very short and then people will post on Facebook. So I took a couple of short quizzes. I found out that the type of reader I am is I'm an explorer, which means I like to learn about different people in different places.
Oh, that fits.
I thought that was interesting. And yes, very fitting. I also found out that the kind of fruit I am is a banana.
Okay.
Now, listen to this. It says, you are a tough banana. You can handle anything. If your friends have an argument, you can fix it.
Wow. And that somehow is a banana. Okay.
Somehow that's a banana.
So that's because you're so appealing. Okay, sorry.
Good one. I also found out that I am only slightly smarter than a fifth grader. But then that was funny because it contrasts with my apostle test. I got the apostle Paul, and I think Paul was pretty smart.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So
that fits too, Joe.
Maybe he's not smarter than a fifth grader either. Well. I don't know. I guess we will find out. Well, if you're somewhat intrigued by little 5-minute quizzes that you find on Facebook, it's kind of fun to see them tell us a little nugget about ourselves. Or maybe you like bigger assessments that tell us how our brains or our personalities work. Those also kind of fascinate me, I have to admit. Well, then you'll be at least somewhat interested in what we're going to talk about today, because my guest for today finds people fascinating as well and has delved into the interesting world of how personality determines how different people see the world differently. And that personality can affect anything from how you fare in relationships to the work that energizes you to even your spiritual growth. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest and I'll get her on the show. Ann Bogle is the creator of the popular blog Modern Mrs. Darcy and the podcast What Should I Read Next? Her popular book lists and reading guides have established Anne as a tastemaker among readers, authors, and publishers. And she has a new book out, Reading People, How Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything. She explores all kinds of frameworks from the Myers-Briggs Indicator to the Enneagram to the highly sensitive person and others. We'll talk about them today as well. And hopefully the knowledge you learn about yourself will be life-changing. You can find Anne on social media and find out more about her on our author page on our website at myfaithradio.com. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Did you notice that one of the quizzes I took was your reader quiz?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
I'm an explorer.
No puns were made.
Yes, no puns were made. I know. I love historical fiction. I think that's probably part of what makes me an explorer, right?
That sounds good to me. Mm. I'm an explorer myself.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, tell me about when you were first introduced to personality theory. What made you realize that you wanted to learn more about it?
Ooh, well, that's an interesting question, because the first few times I encountered personality theory, I couldn't type myself quite right because I was doing it completely wrong, and I never could get any good information out of it, even though it seemed like there was so much potential there if I could only figure it out. But I'd like to think it was because I was young and foolish, or maybe because no one explained the rules to me. But the first time it really made a difference in my life was when my husband and I got married. We were both young and innocent. We were 22. And we had to do premarital counseling, like so many couples do at our church. And we took a series of personality tests with our lay counselors before we got married. And they didn't really go into the types when we got our results back, even though we'd spent an hour filling out hundreds and hundreds of little bubbles with our number two pencils. Mm-hmm. They just said, it looks like you're going to have problems with conflict. Most couples do. It's totally fine. We don't see any red flags here. And then they sent us on our way. And I thought, oh, like, it seems like there could be so much valuable information in all those little Scantron bubbles, but we didn't talk about it. And what do they mean? No red flags. What would that have looked like? Why do they think we're going to have problems with conflict? So I put that on my back burner. And then after we got married, because getting married is very time consuming, I checked a whole bunch of personality books out of the library. And as a newlywed, I think, still, this was 17 years ago, that we were very well suited, but we had such a hard time with conflict when we were first married. Not like we were breaking plates against the walls or anything, but we'd reach an impasse and just wouldn't know what to do next, whether it was about where to go for dinner or where to go on vacation or about like a big deal situation. We just didn't know what to do. And I was sitting down one night reading one of these books that I talk about in Reading People. It was about the Kiersey's temperaments. And I came across this description of what I instantly recognized as my personality type, even though I couldn't have told you what it was, according to Kiersey's temperaments or Myers-Briggs before then, and my husband's personality type, which I had previously never been able to clarify. But the description of how these two types of people act and how they handle conflict was so uncannily accurate, I knew, first of all, that was definitely us. And second of all, our problem wasn't a huge deal. It was a problem, but it was a totally normal, everyday, completely manageable thing, not something to get concerned about or worked up about. And that really opened my eyes to the power of understanding personality, because in one instant, the diagnosis itself was really the cure. It showed me exactly what was going on and what to do about it. And I was hooked.
Well, and you wrote something in your book that I wrote down. It says, people are not crazy. They just aren't us. Is that kind of what you were talking about? And you're learning to understand the personality of someone else helps you understand the us?
Yes, because in that initial situation with my husband and newlyweds trying to manage conflict, and then probably every week, sometimes every day, communication breakdowns happen between people, not because they're behaving irrationally, but they don't act the way we expect them to because they don't act the way that we would in a certain situation, which is all fine and good and neutral. It's not good or bad, but actually it's probably good that the world has so many different kinds of people. But if you expect them to behave as you do, it can get really ugly really quickly.
So different personalities have emerged long before our contemporary culture. You know, Socrates wrote about it. The Apostle Paul even wrote about how we're all different and that different kinds of gifts come from the same spirit, that they're all necessary to building up each other and building up the church. But what is it that we're talking about when we speak about someone's personality?
Ooh, that's tricky, because it does depend on how you define it. So in my book, I do look at 7 popular personality frameworks. And what all these frameworks try to do is identify specific characteristic patterns of thought, behavior, and action that capture something that is true about one aspect of a human being.
So why is it important?
There's a lot.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
There's a lot that these personality frameworks do not capture. They don't necessarily describe your behavior or your core values, but they do capture something that is true about us. And so I don't want to overstate how important it is, but it's also really valuable if you can understand it.
So why is it important to understand our own personality as well as the personality type of others?
Well, I think for 3 key reasons. One, self-knowledge is strangely hard to come by, and these personality frameworks can give us a vocabulary through which to articulate the way we are, a means to understand what it is that makes us unique and makes us different from other people. That sounds really navel-gazing to a lot of people, but once you understand what you're doing, why you act the way you do, you can interact more peacefully with others. You can manage yourself better. You can perhaps find yourself, depending on your stage of life, in a program of education or a career or a volunteer position or a ministry that suits you better because of the way you are made. It can help you interact so much more smoothly with other people when you understand why you do the way you do things and why they do the way they do things. When you understand that those things are not the same, it really can eliminate a lot of the friction that comes when other people with different viewpoints come together. And then just to appreciate, for the third thing, the wide variety of people in the world, how we're all made, what we all do, all the different gifts and abilities and talents and personalities we bring to the table is really amazing to see and helps us appreciate the diversity of humanity.
So where do things like unique skills or passions or ability, where do those fit into this mix?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think on the Venn diagram of abilities, talent, skills, and personality, there are overlaps, but it's not necessarily true that because you're a certain personality, therefore you will be a good accountant or a good manager or an artist or something. Personality is an aspect of that, and understanding your personality can help you identify areas in which you're likely to excel if you put in the time, but they don't necessarily predict what you should be doing with your life. So just because you're a certain personality doesn't mean you're going to be a great painter or basket weaver or writer, but it could be an aspect of your personality that really lets you excel in that field. Mm. Or how about primes the pump? Well, your personality doesn't cause it, but it can definitely be a factor.
And I'm guessing you found that if someone, let's say there are several successful artists, that chances are those successful artists might have a particular personality type, but very different character traits or unique skills and passions.
It could be, yes.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about these frameworks that Anne is talking about and how that applies to reading people. That's the title of her new book, Reading People, How Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Well, have you ever asked God, seen his fingerprints in your life, and said, why in the world did you make me this way? I have to say, I've had that in my prayer life before. Well, personality might have a lot to do with why you do what you do. And our guest for today, Anne Bogle, has written a book called Reading People, How Settling the World Through the Lens of Personality, or Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything. So can personality affect anything from how you fare in relationships to the kind of work that you do, or at least the kind of work that energizes you? And can personality affect how you see your spiritual growth? Well, we'll talk about that in so much more with Anne Bogle today. Well, Anne, in your book, you said the desire that to know ourselves and to know others leads us to what you call a framework assessment. Now, there are some people who might be familiar with very popular frameworks like the Myers-Briggs or StrengthsFinder, but you also mentioned some lesser known assessments that can be great tools in learning to understand ourselves and why we think or act the way we do. Can you give us a few examples of those assessments?
Sure. Well, one is one that's actually been very popular in some churches, and that is Gary Chapman's The Five Love Languages, where he says that we are best able to feel loved in one of five languages. There are things like physical touch or acts of service or quality time. And that has been a real eye-opener for a lot of people, especially in family situations, to understand why sometimes their loved ones don't respond to their acts of love like they expect them to. Say, when your spouse rakes all the leaves in the yard because they love you very, very much. And you're like, huh, why didn't you sit with me and have a cup of coffee this afternoon when we had a free Saturday? If you've ever had a conflict like that in your life or can imagine that happening, Gary Chapman explains why with his love languages.
You just described my relationship right there, Anne.
Oh, no.
No, it's okay. We know. We know now.
Well, that's good that you do, because if you don't know genuine acts of love, of affection coming from the best place in the world can be at best misunderstood or at worst taken as the opposite if you don't understand what's going on.
Mm. Such a good point. I've also noticed that people usually respond or I don't know, act out their love language in to you. In other words, my husband's love language is acts of service. And so he's always doing acts of service for me. My mother-in-law's love language is gifts, and she's always giving gifts. And so I've started looking at that a little differently, where I say, okay, I can get a really good indication of what someone's love language is by the way that they are loving me. And it's been a nice little clue for me.
that's great. And that's not surprising because Gary Chapman says, if you have no idea what your love language is, think about how you like to express love to others. Mm-hmm. That's not always going to be your diagnosis, but a big percentage of the time, that's the best way to find. Because when you think of love, those are the actions you think of.
Mm. Good point.
Interesting. Well, another one of the lesser-known frameworks that I really like, calling it a framework is kind of a stretch, but how about a concept? It's Elaine Aaron's research about the highly sensitive person. And this blew my mind when I first encountered it because she put words to something I've been experiencing for much of my life, but had never realized was part of a physiological thing that was true about me. The highly sensitive person, if you're hearing this for the first time, isn't someone who is touchy or emotional or difficult to please or easily angered. When Elaine Aaron says that someone is highly sensitive, she's talking about their nervous system, that it's more responsive to stimuli than the typical non-sensitive person's nervous system. And I said person, but actually in her research, she's found that this is true across species. You could have a highly sensitive puppy or a highly sensitive gerbil. 80 to 85% of the population has your standard issue nervous system, but that extra 15 to 20% runs at a higher frequency than others. So I'm a highly sensitive person. One of my children is a highly sensitive person. This manifests in different ways, but what it often looks like is you're very sensitive to things like lights or sounds or textures. If you as a child or you have a child who goes berserk when their seams on their socks aren't lining quite right, or if they just can't settle down when there's a tag itching them at the back of their neck, or if they melt into a ball when the lights come on at the movie theater, or the surround sound is really, really loud, there's a good chance that what you have is a highly sensitive person on your hands. Mm-hmm. And realizing what this is and how it affects you or the people you live with or love or work with can really help you implement some changes that can make you feel a lot more comfortable in your day-to-day.
Mm, I have one of those for my child. As he's getting older, it's less and less, but when he was younger, it was very apparent. And it was things like if I was driving him in the car and I had on my big winter puffy coat and it makes noise when you turn the steering wheel or turn to the side, and he couldn't stand that. He couldn't stand that sound. Or if he found a t-shirt that was comfortable for him where the seams were in the right place, or socks, I would buy just as many of those t-shirts as I possibly could, because it was affecting him and the way that he would feel comfortable and at peace. And so I understand a little bit about that, and I was so comforted to see that is a real thing.
Yes, that was my reaction too. It made me feel normal, mm-hmm. in a really good way to think, oh, like there's nothing wrong with me. I am actually suited to live in this world. Mm-hmm. There's just certain things I need to do. Like if three of my children are talking to me at the same time, I feel like I'm going to have a meltdown. In realizing that it wasn't because I was a terrible parent or I lacked patience, but because my poor nervous system could not handle that much stimuli all at once, especially if the radio was on, mm-hmm. or there was music playing in the background. There was too much auditory input at once and I couldn't deal, but take it a piece at a time and I was just fine. And that's true for so many people. And once they understand what's going on, they can actually do something about it.
Hmm. How about introverts and extroverts? I know there's been quite a bit written lately, but I think that there's still a lot of misconceptions on what it means to be an introvert and an extrovert. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And I think you're right. I just love Susan Cain's book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, that came out in 2011. And in my mind, everyone read the book. And now they know what introverts and extroverts are. But I found in talking about reading people that that's just not the case. A common misperception about introverts is that they are shy, socially awkward, and couldn't possibly stand in the front of the room and deliver a speech or be a lot of fun to chat with at a party if you're a stranger. And extroverts also get a bad rap for being flighty or overly gregarious or shallow. But really, what it means to be an introvert is that when it comes time to recharge When you've had a draining experience and you need to get your energy up again, you prefer to retreat into your inner world and have some solitude or some quiet to feel like yourself again. If you're an extrovert, it's the opposite. It's being on your own, in your own space, in the quiet that drains you, and you find people very energizing. And we all have a different level of balance between how much time we want to spend. This was revolutionary for me. Introvert and extrovert are verbs. So what is our balance between how much time do we need to spend introverting, spending time in solitude and quiet in our own minds with our own thoughts, and how much time do we need to spend extroverting out in the world with other people, taking action in the physical external world? Like, where that balance is for us, it's important to know if we're going to feel like healthy human beings functioning in a healthy way.
So it sounds like something like introvert and extrovert would be something really necessary or helpful, I guess, when you're talking about getting along in a marriage. Is that true?
Oh, I think all kinds of stories I've heard from friends and strangers about couples who didn't understand what the other needed. Just like you were saying about love languages, if you think the idea of a great Friday night because of the week you had is to curl up with a book and drink a cup of coffee because you're an introvert. Actually, you know what? The introvert would probably not be drinking coffee at night. So curl up with your cup of decaf in your book on a Friday night because you are drained from an exhausting week. That could really feel unloving to your extroverted spouse who thinks, what is wrong with you? Everybody knows on Friday you need to get together with friends and order pizza and play really, really loud board games. Mm-hmm. The two people could want different things for reasons that are both completely valid for them, and it could be what they each need. But if one doesn't understand why the other needs what they do, you can think, why don't you understand me? Why do you need something else? I just don't get it. So there's still a balance to be struck between a marriage where one is an introvert and one is an extrovert, because they will prefer different things at different times. But when you know what you're dealing with, you can work out the balance without feeling like your spouse just doesn't love you because they want something different. Mm.
I just told my husband that I need to know for sure on Wednesday that we're going out on Friday, and then I can prepare myself. And that seems to work really well. And then he needs to know that sometimes I do need to sit with a quiet book, and he can go have some fun with his friends, or, you know, find something to do that involves, that will serve his purposes as well. And we've talked about those kinds of things a lot, but you're right. If no one makes you, alerts you to the fact that you might be different, but can still be very in love with each other, then you would never know to have those conversations.
Right. And it sounds like you all have really found a good means of communication, how you can speak about these things in a way that's not loaded, but just very practical. It's become a practical issue since you understand what's going on.
Well, we're talking about personality today, about reading people, how seeing the world through the lens of personality changes everything. My guest for today is Anne Bogle. She's just written this fascinating book with lots of information about personality types. We do have a few to give away. I'd love to get one in your hand. You can give us a call at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Carissa will answer your call and put your name in a drawing that we'll do at the end of the show. We'll be right back with Anne Bogle on Connecting Faith.
Cause you've got personality.
Walk.
Personality.
Talk.
Personality.
Style.
Personality.
Charm.
Personality.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. We're talking about personality today with author Anne Bogle. She's written a book called Reading People, How Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything. And one of the things that people who I've said, I love this kind of thing, and my friends will say, I don't want to be labeled because then it just puts me in a box. So does all of the frameworking and the personality kind of assessments, does it tend to put people in a box, or is there some freedom there?
Well, first of all, I totally get what they're saying. Nobody likes to think that they were just like model number 342 that ran off the factory assembly line. But what I found is that it's helpful to know that these personality frameworks are not trying to capture who you are. They're trying to capture a tiny aspect of who you are in a very specific, finite way. So I don't feel like less of a unique individual, knowing that I wear like a size 11 shoe, or that my eyes are blue, or that my hair is brown. Like, it's just a small portion of who I am, but it doesn't make me who I am. However, when I go to the shoe store, I know which section to go to so I can get shoes that actually fit, because I need shoes to live my life. Mm-hmm. Or, you know what, my hair is just going to be brown. So there's not really anything to do with that. But it's a tool that can help you in your life, but it doesn't necessarily determine what kind of life you live.
Fascinating. You know, one of the assessments that I had never heard about is the Enneagram, which you've written is the driving motivation behind everything you do. So, of course, that makes me want to learn a lot more about it. Tell me a little bit about the Enneagram.
Yes, the Enneagram is enjoying a bit of a renaissance in Christian circles these days, popularized by Christian writers such as Richard Rohr, a Catholic priest, and Ian Morgan Cron had a great book come out last fall called The Road Back to You that he wrote with Susanna Stabile, I believe her last name is, a certified Enneagram coach. So the Enneagram has been really helpful to me personally, but it's also a tough one because it is a personality typing system that says there are nine types of people, each of whom interact with the world in their own unique ways. And what each type captures is what your underlying motivation is behind everything you do. And that sounds really warm and fuzzy, or at least neutral, except Christian practitioners like Rohr often call these nine types that they identify your besetting sin. So your motivation as a fallen human is not necessarily something that you would be proud of. Like, the type twos are motivated by the need to be needed, and the type threes feel like they need to succeed in order to feel loved. Fours feel like they need to be special. So this is not a personality typing system that makes you feel really great about yourself in the moment, but if you power through, and a lot of people are doing it these days, it can be so useful because it will help you see why and how you act in unhealthy ways. And once you're able to identify that and start paying attention to it, it can be like a spiritual discipline. You can start asking yourself, why did that make me so unhappy? Why was that my knee-jerk reaction? Why did I feel compelled to say that maybe not so kind thing to my friend? And the Enneagram is a tool that helps you evaluate why you do the things you do, especially when they're not things that you're proud of.
That sounds like a difficult thing to go through, but very necessary, especially if we want to grow. And I'm guessing it would also affect the way that we would want to grow spiritually. I mean, getting in touch with the way that God has made us would allow us then to kind of embrace that rather than kind of hate on those things that we don't like about ourselves.
Yes, very true. And being able to see what it is in you that where you're operating out of darkness. So something that several Enneagram practitioners have said is that what the tool does is helps you shine a light on the darker parts of yourself, your darker thoughts, your darker behaviors, you know, things that you would much prefer to leave hidden because they're really uncomfortable. But it's only when you do shine a light on those things and drag them into the open that something can be done about them.
Tell me a little bit about your journey. Was there anything specific that you learned about your particular personality that really changed you? And how did you use that information to become stronger?
Yeah. Well, let me give you a little example and a big one. So a little one is, and by that I just mean like not to the soul level importance. I read something great in a book about Myers-Briggs that captured my type once. I'm an INFP. I'm a great idea person, but I was reading this book called Creative You that I talk about in Reading People, and it said, well, if you're an INFP, when it comes to your work, you are a veritable lightning storm of ideas, but your bolts don't often hit the ground. And I felt so convicted by that, how I love to start things and I'm not so great at finishing them. And reading that was really a little bit of a lightning bolt for me, which I'm sorry for the pun. I didn't mean it that way. But it did make me realize that that was true about me. And if I don't keep an eye on actually finishing the things that I start, I won't finish. And just being aware that that's a blind spot for me, that it's a way in which I tend to trip up, helps me kind of monitor my own behavior so that that doesn't happen, which has been really, really useful to me. On a like a bigger level, I encountered the Enneagram through a friend, but I also use it in counseling. I'm a type 9, and I did not realize this at the beginning of my journey with the specific framework, but when I went into counseling for the first time in my 30s, I found out that I had some boundary issues that I didn't realize were anything other than completely normal, because it was normal to my experience. Like, I lived through my own eyes, and that was the way I'd always been and always seen the world. And the tool of the Enneagram really helped me see that I wasn't the only one with these problems. Like, they weren't completely unique. And I mean that in a really comforting way. Like, this is something that people do when people trip up. But this is something that you may find effective in moving forward. And just being able to use what I learned about my personality, what it can look like when it's redeemed, basically, and what it can look like when it's still fallen and broken in the spectrum in between, has been so helpful and encouraging and motivating and equipping to me as I learn more about myself, about the system, about God, about the spiritual life, and then move forward from where I am now.
Mm. Well, one of the things I loved about doing StrengthsFinder is there was a great point about how we can use our strengths to manage what may be our weaknesses. And I remember putting into place that very moment that I learned about that, that I'm really high achiever. I'm really low woo. And so I made a little game for myself that when I'm in the situation where I'm in a room full of strangers, and that may be as a guest, that may be as a date, that may be as a friend, but regardless of what that situation is, I make a little game where I have to talk to 15 people. Now, that's really difficult because I don't want to talk to 15 people, but my achiever instinct kind of takes over and somehow I'm able to manage through that situation. And so I love StrengthsFinder for that reason, that it's not, oh, boo-hoo, you're not these things. You can manage those things that you're not and maybe wish you were with the things that you are in the unique way that God has made you.
Yes, absolutely. And I love your little game.
Well, my husband's high woo, so if I'm with him, this is just not a problem. I just hang on to his arm and we're all over the place. So it's nice to ride in his coattails. Well, as we're coming to a close, I just want you to talk a little bit about just how understanding yourself and kind of the way your personality acts and reacts to others. How has it helped you to just appreciate the difference of others in your purview?
Oh, well, it's so interesting. Like you were just saying about StrengthsFinder, if you take that assessment, you will find out that you have what it does is it pulls out your top five potential areas of strengths, which sounds great and makes you feel really special as you read about your five areas. But there are almost 35 more that you don't have. You're one specific Myers-Briggs type, and you can read about it and see what that says about you. But there are 15 more that you are not. So it's really fun in these personality frameworks, or it can be. Sometimes it's mortifying, but it's also really fun to read about what makes you special and what makes you you. But if you're reading a book about personality, all the information about the people who are not you is right there on the page. And it's fascinating to read through all the other descriptions and say, like, oh, people think like this? This comes naturally to other people? That's even a skill? I didn't know that was possible. And learning more about personality has really helped me appreciate not only what there is about me that's unique and that I can use in my work, in my church, in my spiritual life, in my family, but also how much I can't do. And I guess that could sound a little depressing, but mostly it makes me feel so glad to be part of such a vibrant community in my home, in my neighborhood, in the world. So grateful that I am just one of many, because I cannot bring it all to the table on my own. I just have a little portion. But if we all show up, then we can do great things together. It's really made me appreciate my place in the world and how small it is. But I mean that in the best, healthiest sense.
Well, and it brings us right back to those words of the Apostle Paul saying that we've all been gifted in different ways, that God has made us all unique, but we still all need each other. And we wouldn't want to cut off an arm in order to save a toe, that we're all going to be part of this journey together. And when you're looking at those personalities, I guess I've noticed that there's always someone willing to fill that gap that you can't fill. And so in work, that means hiring someone who has a skill set that you don't have. And in relationships, it means knowing that you're not going to be great in conflict, but maybe someone else is going to be able to help you in that conversation. And in marriage, I mean, it just seems like the better I know what my spouse's strengths and weaknesses are, the better I can try to account for them with my strengths and weaknesses. So it's such a great concept that you've just explored here and given us such courage to be willing to find out a little bit about us and a little bit about others so that we can love better.
Yes, I love the way you put that.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I also, just before we go, I just want to encourage people. I'm in a book club, Anne, so of course I have just soaked up your podcast, What Should I Read Next? And it's just so amazing. If you ever have trouble picking books for your book club, this is such a great resource that Anne has created. And tell us a little bit more about how they can find you.
Sure. Well, you can find me on my blog. That's modernmrsdarcy.com. Or the podcast is on iTunes at What Should I Read Next?
Well, Anne, thanks so much for joining us. And you can pick up a copy of Anne's book, Reading People, How Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything. Anne, thanks for this great resource and just for the time you've taken to explain to all of us the great advantage of knowing ourselves a little bit better.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Have a blessed day. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Well, I hope you heard my conversation with Anne Bogle on Reading People, learning about how personality affects us and other people as well. You can hear a podcast of that, of course, if you head to our website at myfaithradio.com and click on Connecting Faith. I also had a conversation recently with Kathy Cook, and she talked more about how we get to know our children and their intelligences or smarts. You also call them intelligences and say everyone has them, but maybe more are awakened than others. So what does it mean to be word smart? I think most people are probably most familiar with what it might mean to be word smart.
Right. I agree with you. And it's the first one I usually discuss because it's what I call a school smart. Because when we are being word smart, we are thinking with words. We talk, listen, read, and write. And, of course, those are things that we need to do all day long in school and even in Sunday school. So when we're thinking with words inside of our head as well as outside of our head, if you will, we are being word smart. We tend to talk when we're excited, and we might have a conversation inside of our head that you don't know we're having. And so it looks like we're listening to you, but in reality, we're listening to our own internal voice, which is really a pretty funny but can get us into trouble because we stop listening to the voice we're supposed to hear.
Boy, that
so we're
sounds
good with vocabulary. We're good with reading and vocabulary.
Okay, so people who are word smart would be very successful in school or maybe very successful in a career that had to do with that thinking part, right?
Right. Spelling, vocabulary. You know, what's interesting to bring this up right away is that none of these intelligences ever work alone. They always work in tandem with others. So, for instance, we're going to get to logic smart, which is thinking with questions, and we tend to enjoy nonfiction. So if you're a word smart, logic smart child, you're better at report writing than you are at creative writing. And this is when kids find this out, oh my goodness, it's so empowering for them to understand, okay, I'm not stupid because I can't do this well. I'm just smart in a different way. And it really spins their whole interpretation of themselves, which is very exciting. The power of this that we're sharing with people today is very cool. And let's look at it this way, Joe. Different is different. It's not bad.
Right. That's true.
Oh, That's so powerful. Just get that in your mind. My kids are different from me. They're not wrong. I'm not wrong. We're not bad. We are different in the way that we think and process information.
Sure. So someone who's logic smart then, which is the second one on the list, is someone who thinks with questions. What do you mean by that? What does it mean to think with questions?
Yeah, we reason our way to ideas. We are the why, how come, what, and when and where people. We love it when the world makes sense. We're very logic driven, so we see the inconsistencies. We see the absurdity of things, and that can be really challenging for us. We tend to like math and science. Math makes sense. 2 + 2 is always 4, versus you see the letters READ, and it could be 2 different words, and then red is also READ. So that's very frustrating to those of us who are logic smart. We love science because we tend to like to discover truth on our own. Hmm. So kids who discover, invent, explore are constantly asking us, you know, how come and why, and they want the reason behind the decisions we make. That's often logic smart. And we need to say to our kids, you know, I'm the parent, I'm in charge, go sit down. You know, sometimes we don't need to give them the reasons because they are the children. But if we can understand that the reason they want to know is because they're driven with a need to know because of the kind of brain they have.
Hmm. So there are some more kind of creative, I guess, if you were to put them on a spectrum, the next three seem to be a little bit more on that creative perspective. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be picture smart, to think in pictures?
Yeah, we're the ones who think with our eyes. We think with an imagination, with our eyes in pictures. We doodle and we draw on paper, and we also doodle and draw in our mind. And so if I say that an octopus is playing baseball, listeners just saw that, especially if they're picture smart. And I didn't tell you to see it. I didn't even give you time to see it, but you saw it instantly because words create pictures in your mind. You tend to be the ones that are drawn to fiction and history because as you read, it comes alive in your mind's eye. I'm not very picture smart. I don't tend to read very much fiction. And if I do, I almost always read mysteries. Hmm. So again, we can help our kids to understand why certain things are appealing to them and why certain things are harder, but yet they must be done because obedience is right and your teacher has assigned it. So, you know, so go do it. These are the kids who are also tend to be good at art. But again, there's different intelligences that would come alongside of that.
So what does it mean to be music smart? It seems like it should be logical how we think music smart is. But as I read your book, I thought, well, maybe it's not everything I think. Explain what that means.
Yeah, it is rhythms and melodies. You know, so at the most basic level, it is music. And intelligences always begin with interest and then turn into ability if that interest is affirmed by the significant adults in the child's life. Right now, I think in our culture, we have a whole lot of music smart interested people. So there are people who are constantly listening to music, lots of, you know, pods, and it actually concerns me because I think it allows them to reject people, which is never right. But then that interest, it won't always show up as ability. So there's a hierarchy of giftedness for each of these smarts. You might have a child who's very interested in music, uses it to calm down, uses it as a joy place. And you might have another child who's begging to take piano lessons and is actually really good on the piano and has learned the flute and wants to go to the classical concert with you, you know, at the symphony this summer. That's more of a music smart bent than the child who just enjoys it. And we can use this for studying, too. You know, how do you guys spell Mississippi? There's not a single person listening who doesn't spell Mississippi with a rhythm and a melody. Mm-hmm. And you'll never not know that word because music is so good for memory.
Mm-hmm.
So I come from a very music smart family. So my brother and I grew up listening to music. Both of my parents sang in the church choir. I began piano lessons in grade 1, viola in grade 4, was a part of band and orchestra all the way through graduate school. And so today I don't play instruments anymore, but it still is a big passion of my life and something that I do with my spare time and with my money. And so if you want children to enjoy life, again, the music and picture, you're correct that they're more creative. They might not be as essential academically in school, although these are the electives that keep some kids in school. And I love that this model of the brain affirms that these kids are smart. The reason that we're good musically is because we're smart that way. We're not just talented. We are also smart. It's not just the kid who does well at math. It's the kid who earns a consistent A in orchestra and is challenging for first chair and wins it. That is also smart.
Well, we've gone through what it means to be word smart, logic smart, picture smart, and music smart. So the next one is body smart. What does it mean to be body smart?
These are the kids and adults who think by movement and touch. They might be athletes. They might be actors and can make their whole body look angry even though they're not angry. They might sculpt with clay, which is an example of picture and body coming together. They might be dancers, and they might be truck drivers someday and teachers who talk with their hands. But we're the movement and touch people. We'll actually learn best when you allow us to maybe pace with a clipboard or study spelling words while we're swinging on the swing set. And these might have been your boys. Many boys do tend to appear to be more this way, although as a girl, I was very body smart as a kid and an athlete all the way through college. So it shows up again in a variety of people.
So what does it mean to be nature smart? I think I need one of those people in my household. What does it mean to be nature smart?
Yeah, well, these are the ones who would rather be outside than inside, and they get a lot of their joy from nature. They go outside when they're excited, actually, and they actually like to get dirty. They're rocks, plants, minerals kind of people. They like earth science and biology more than they do general science and chemistry, and they think with patterns. So their eyes are very good at the pattern. So it's related to being picture smart in that it's both of these are used in their eyes, but the nature smart people remember where the blue goes on a blue bird versus a blue jay. They remember if this is an elm tree or an oak tree or a white pine, because they actually can remember shapes, designs, colors, even textures would be something that a nature smart person might get into. Absolutely. Really, really interesting. When I talk to kids, 80% of them raise their hands to say that they love to get dirty. Mm. And it cracks me up, but that's almost always indicative of some nature smart being developed.
So what does it mean to be people smart? This sounds incredibly valuable as well, and that it might be more pronounced in others than some others.
Right. It's actually, I think, maybe the most important one to develop today, even more so than word and logic. People smart people think with other people. So we are brainstormers and networkers. We're the ones who know what we know when we hear ourselves say it and someone responds. So this is the child who will probably not do well studying alone in his bedroom, but might actually do better in the den, living room, kitchen, or patio, being surrounded by some other people. Even if we're not talking to the people, people smart people get energy intellectually, believe it or not, from the people that they're surrounded by. The reason that I say it's so important is I think we need to learn to live in community. And we have an isolation factor going on with texting and social media and gaming and eyes looking down. And so we tend to maybe go to Siri on the phone rather than to Dad, which is really a tragedy. The other reason I think it's so valuable is that this is how you know body language and can respond appropriately. So if you walk into a room and you recognize that somebody is sad, mad, angry, happy, joyful, content, your ability to figure that out is because you're people smart, and you can look at a face, facial features, the way they're holding their body, and know. This is how kids know who is safe and who is for them and who is against them. This is how your preteen can go into a summer camp or a youth group, walk into a room, and figure out where to sit, where she may feel more welcomed. This is how a fourth grader who goes to VBS next week can figure out how to walk into a situation and figure out where to sit and be welcomed. It's very, very important that we develop this with kids.
We have one more smart I'd love to get to. What does it mean to be self-smart? I think we all want this for ourselves and for our children, but what does it mean to be self-smart?
Yeah, interesting. These are the people who think deeply inside of themselves with reflection. So they can tend to be quiet. They can tend to think they're slow because no question is easy. Every question has to be analyzed and thought through, and the answer just has to feel right. So even if you say, you know, what restaurant you want to go to tonight, they can be like paralyzed by that because there's like 1,000 restaurants within a 20-mile radius, and I just don't know what I'm in the mood for. Well, just decide. It's really hard for self-smart people to decide. It has to feel right. We know ourselves well, and this is a great quality to, again, developing your children is a self-awareness. And these kids and adults, when you're being self-smart, you crave quiet, peace, privacy, and space. Quiet, peace, privacy, and space. And we live in a loud, hurried, crowded world. This intelligence is essential to awakening our children because it's what allows them to be alone and content when they're alone and not lonely when they're alone. Mm. And they discover the joy of knowing the knowing and feeling good about the discovery of truth and emotion. So it's very, very important intelligence. Absolutely. And it can be hard in school because it's hurry, hurry, here's the next book, here's the next question, finish this. And we don't give self-smart people enough time, and that can be really stressful for them.
So great to have you here listening to Connecting Faith today. Have a great weekend. I'm Joe Bender.
Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.